This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You're experiencing water stress and crop failures. That will add to the maybe existing political instability that's already ongoing. And so that will be an extra ingredient to the explosive mix that's already in place.
That was climate scientist Paolo Sippi of the Imperial College of London, who says yesterday's hottest day ever for the world also is a precursor to how places like Africa will be more affected by such heat waves. Details coming up. Also, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir plans to run for re-election. And an artist turns migrants' life vests into fashion. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir last night pledged that delayed elections would go ahead next year as planned and says he runs for re-election. Kiir's been the nation's only president since he led it to independence from Sudan in 2011. The world's youngest nation has lurched from crisis to crisis during Kiir's tenure. It now is held together by a fragile unity government that Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar lead. A transition period was meant to conclude with elections in February 2023, but the government has not met key provisions of the agreement, including drafting a constitution. No other candidate has declared their candidacy, but his historical rival, Machar, is expected to run. In August, the two leaders extended their transitional government by 2 years beyond the agreed deadline, citing the need to address challenges that impede the implementation of the peace agreement. A new report by Heritage for Peace, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving cultural artifacts in times of war, has detailed the destruction and looting of museums and cultural sites during Sudan's civil conflict. Parties outside Sudan are quickly drawing up plans to evacuate the antiquities to safety. Henry Wilkins reports from N'Djamena, Chad.
Sudan has a rich cultural heritage dating back 3,000 years to the Kushite civilization, which built these pyramids near the town of Meroe and even ruled neighboring Egypt around 700 BC. Sudan's civil war, which started in April, is now threatening that heritage. Experts have confirmed this video on social media shows soldiers from the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces entering an archaeological laboratory in Khartoum that houses ancient mummies. The video alarmed museum directors in Sudan and other experts worldwide. Ismail Elnor is an expert in Sudanese cultural heritage at Birmingham University in the UK.
We are so worried that the damage of the war and the conflict is reaching these places. The bombing as well for the universities, for the museums have taken place in varied cities in Sudan, in particular in Khartoum and Jenina, Niala.
Some artifacts from Sudan are held safely in foreign collections, like this one at the British Museum. But a report published on June 28th by Heritage for Peace, a non-profit dedicated to preserving cultural artefacts in times of war, says those left behind in Sudan are at risk. An archaeologist who worked on the report says it confirms that a historical market was the latest cultural site to be damaged or destroyed. Tomomi Fashia is an archaeologist with the University of Warsaw.
What we just heard yesterday was the destruction of an old part of Omdurman Market, and this has been completely destroyed by fire. There are already a damage to the museums in Darfur region. Sultan Ali Dinar Museum has been damaged.
In downtown Khartoum, museums and other cultural heritage sites sit a few hundred meters from the country's military headquarters and intelligence services, the setting for intense fighting during the war. Experts say they've used satellite images to identify damage to these sites. Interested parties outside of Sudan are doing what they can to preserve the country's heritage. Salah Ahmed, the former director of Sudan's National Corporation for Antiquities and Museums, says he is training volunteers to evacuate the country's artifacts.
In case they feel there is a real threat to the museums, to prepare who is going to do the evacuation itself, how the objects can be handled, where are they going to be hidden. So we are now in this emergency situation.
Meanwhile, Heritage for Peace says that it's organising fundraising events at Western museums to help pay for more people on the ground, and that it's also tried lobbying Sudan's two warring sides at peace talks in Saudi Arabia. Isbir Sabrine is a co-founder of Heritage for Peace.
That's what we tried to push on the negotiation table in Jeddah a few weeks ago. That heritage destruction is an issue required by the international law.
Ahmed says Merowe has more visitors than ever, as Sudanese citizens who rarely travel outside Khartoum head north to escape the fighting. Even this is causing damage to the site, he says, as volunteers are unable to manage the increased traffic. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Jemena, Chad.
Health organizations in Sudan's White Nile state said at least 13 children have died over the past week due to a suspected measles outbreak. An official with the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders said Sudan's conflict and the approach of the rainy season could make the situation much worse. Michael Atit reports from Juba, South Sudan.
Officials with an international medical organization known as MSF say they remain concerned about an increase of suspected measles cases among children in Sudan's White Nile state. Speaking to VOA via a messaging application from Nairobi, Michelle Sangma, MSF's health advisor, says MSF's ground team have documented more than 200 suspected cases of measles among children in the last month. He says out of that number, 72 were admitted to hospitals and 13 died.
We are also seeing an increasing numbers of suspected measles in our other projects, such as in Blue Nile State in Sudan. And in Renk, on the other side of the border in South Sudan, we are also seeing increasing measles cases in our measles isolation ward. So the situation for people fleeing the conflict is desperately concerning.
The MSF officials say the nearly three-month-old conflict in Sudan between the army and the rival paramilitary group has created a huge medical need and intense pressure on healthcare facilities all over the country. Sangma says MSF and other aid agencies are concerned about the collapsing health system. He says health centers still in operation are struggling to cope up with limited supplies and staff. Sangma notes that as the rainy season draws near, there is an increased possibility of disease outbreaks among the millions of people displaced from their homes by the war. The organization say there is a need to step up services like vaccination, nutritional support, shelter, water and sanitation.
The rainy season is fast approaching. We are very concerned about the rise in waterborne diseases such as cholera, and also to note that the malaria is also very much endemic in this region. We need to scale up. We need experienced medical expertise on the ground.
VOA reached out to Mustafa Jabralla Ahmed, Director General of the Ministry of Health in Blue Nile, for this story, but he declined to comment, saying he was busy with meetings. More than 2.8 million people have been displaced due to the Sudan conflict, including over 2.2 million internally, according to a report released by the International Organization for Migration this week. The violence makes it difficult for people to access health care, with many getting treatment late as it is dangerous to travel to health facilities. Michael Atit for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
Several climate scientists say the world recorded the hottest day on record yesterday. North Africa has recently seen temperatures near 50 degrees Celsius. Polo Sippi, a climate scientist and lecturer at the Grantham Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the Imperial College of London, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam yesterday's sweltering heat underscores how some areas would be more affected by climate change than others, especially Africa, because of different exposures to risk.
What happens is you have a certain change in the climate, But how that's experienced by people depends on how well a particular country or community is prepared to face with the impacts. And to give you one example, one of the great impacts of climate change is sea level rise. So the sea levels are rising globally. We've already had 20 centimeters of global mean sea level rise since the beginning of the 20th century. And that's set to continue. We expect at least another 30 centimeters or so by the end of this century. And that is a lot, actually, for coastal communities, and particularly in countries that are less able to equip themselves with infrastructure to protect their coasts against rising seas and storm surges and so on. Maybe another one I can mention is, changes in the patterns of rainfall. So some regions are going to get drier, some are going to get wetter. And so you have risks associated with flooding on the one hand, but also droughts on the other hand. And that requires a solid water supply infrastructure. So you need to have the infrastructure in place to bring the water where it's needed. And again, countries are quite unequal in that respect.
Let's talk about just yesterday in North Africa, it was said that the temperature was recorded at 50 degrees Celsius. Oh my gosh. I mean, how are people surviving in that kind of heat?
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, that points to the health impacts of climate change, and particularly the hot spells that are becoming both more frequent and more intense. Just to give some context, scientists have calculated, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change specifically in their last assessment report, they calculated that for 1 degree of global warming, and we're already at beyond that, 1 degree Celsius of global warming, we're at 1.2 degrees currently, we expect a fivefold increase in the likelihood of an extreme heat wave that would have occurred only once in 50 years. So that's happening five times as often now. And at the same time, it's also more intense. So there are studies showing that some regions on the globe are likely to become, at least at certain times, inhabitable in a sense. You know, just being there will be a health hazard unless you have air conditioning and are in an air conditioned room.
It sounds to me that you're saying whole communities are going to have to move that don't have air conditioning. They're not like America. They don't have air conditioning where they can just, you know, if they don't have it in their own home, they can go to a shopping mall or something. They have no escape. So are these communities going to have to up and leave?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sure that one of the impacts of climate change, one of the more indirect impacts, will be mass migration. Or I think a lot of these impacts will be subtle in the sense that it's not always the case that the linkages are so clear, but you can expect, for example, that if in one region you're experiencing water stress and crop failures, that will add to the maybe existing political instability that's already ongoing. And so that will be an extra ingredient to the explosive mix that's already in place and might trigger civil wars or mass migration because of poverty and so on. So all of this is speculative, but I think it's not far-fetched to envisage that more migrations will happen as a result of climate change.
That's Paul Sippy, a climate scientist at the Imperial College of London. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Libya's House of Representatives and its consultative state council intend to issue a new roadmap next week that will allow for the formation of a new government and the drafting of electoral laws. The aim is to hold long-delayed parliamentary and presidential elections. Some analysts and political observers see the move as a challenge to the head of the Government of National Unity, Abdulhamid Dabiba, who has refused to hand over power. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The HOR, the House of Representatives, and the HCS, the High Council of State, are two unelected rump parliaments left over from 2014 and 2012 elections that were given this role by the 2015 Libyan political agreement and decisions by the 2021 UN-sponsored Libya Political Dialogue Forum. The role of these two rump parliaments is just to organize elections. It's not to tell the executive branch what to do. Now, the roadmap that's proposed is the result result of what's called the 6+6 negotiations. So six representing the East and six representing the West that were happening in late May, early June, and broke down on June 6th when they failed to solve the thorniest electoral issues. The biggest issue was who can run for president. And the main reason that was an issue is that when the elections that were supposed to happen in 2021 broke down, the main reason was that Haftar, the general of the East, who's considered a war criminal by the international community, and Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of the former leader, were approved to run for president. And that was a problem. Now, their supporters are trying to block the current president, Dbeibah, from the West from running based on promises in 2020 not to run before this issue of anti-democratic candidacies came up. Now, it's clear Dbeibah won't step down until there's free and fair elections. And now this roadmap's been rolled out, which we don't know yet if it's going to be a step forward, because there's no indication that the big disagreements over the elections have been solved. It may just be that they're announcing a roadmap with a date, they said March 2024, without an actual solution to the bigger problems. Now, the Eastern government, they're threatening an oil blockade of 70% of Libya's oil if they don't get their way. So it's unclear whether this roadmap that's going to be announced is real or it's just a ruse because the East is threatening to blockade the oil again, which would devastate the economy and devastate European oil and gas supplies in the context of the Ukraine war.
HOR Speaker Aqila Saleh emphasized the need for a unified government on the entire Libyan soil with specific tasks to organize the elections. And the State Council head Khaled al-Mishri said if Dbeibah refuses to hand over power to the new government, other measures will be taken. Who would be able to take such measures?
Saleh can say whatever he wants, but he only represents a third of the population in the East, and he doesn't have the power to do that. So the East has been trying to tear apart the Western government almost since it was formed in 2021 after the failure to take Tripoli by force in 2019 failed. And then they tried to install an Eastern prime minister on two occasions with armed conflicts, you may remember, in 2021, 2022, and that failed. And now they're trying to bring down the Western government by this new method. So this caretaker government idea, it seems to be a bad idea because it's just trying to replace the Western government without necessarily a government that the West wants, which is supposed to come out of elections. Now, the big question behind that is why is Mishri agreeing? It seems to be that because certain militias in the West involved in arms trafficking and drug smuggling and human trafficking to Europe were bombed by Turkish drones in three locations in May and June. And these militias were very angry and have some influence on Mishri, which is why there isn't Mishri's sort of trying to put this pressure on Dbeibah to step down for this caretaker government, but Dbeibah was not going to step down. In the meantime, the United Nations and the U.S. has sort of picked up this talking point that a caretaker government, if the Libyans want it, you know, might be good to have in place to help organize elections. But what they're not explaining well is that there's absolutely no way that Dbeibah, who runs the Western government, is going to step down without elections. And he said this on multiple occasions. So Mishri can say that we want this to caretaker government, but he doesn't have the power to force Dbeibah out of power. And one other point to make is that elections have been happening in Libya since 2011, in the West, right up till the present. In the East, there have been no elections since Haftar, the general, took over in 2014. And what they're trying to do is use either the pre-election negotiation or the elections themselves to force a candidate in that the East and that Egypt supports, what some people are referring to as a selection and not an election, because they haven't really proven their democratic bona fides. So that's the issue right now.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Founded by a former refugee, Epimonia, a company based in the U.S. state of Minnesota, turns material from life jackets worn by refugees into fashion accessories and other items of clothing. VOA's Kali Abdu has the story.
These are not ordinary life jackets. They were worn by refugees from different parts of the world who risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea to reach Europe. Now they've been turned into a fashion collection created by Epimonia, a Minnesota-based company launched in 2018. The parents of Epimonia's founder, Mohamed Malim, fled Somalia during the conflict in the 1990s. Malim was born in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp complex before resettling in the U.S.
We take those life jackets and turn it into a fashion piece. You know, the purpose behind that is, you know, to create awareness of the refugee crisis globally and to support refugees, you know, through sustainable fashion.
Malim's fashion collection and some of the life jackets and boats used by the refugees were part of a live exhibit on June 17 at a gallery in Washington. The event featured installations and poetry that humanized stories of the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean Sea.
This exhibit basically is a moment where, you know, we respect and we honor the refugees, you know, fleeing. We tell the stories of the refugees that flee from the home country.
The UN's International Organization for Migration, or IOM, says the Mediterranean Sea is one of the world's most dangerous maritime crossings. The route has so far claimed more than 20,000 lives since 2014, according to IOM's director.
The boat starts to slow down. The captain turns around with a loaded gun and says it's getting heavy.
For this exhibit, Malim collaborated with Somali-American poet and author Elias Yabaro, who goes by his stage name Alaku. Yabaro says the goal of the event is to bring people closer to personal stories.
The new story of this type of journey is always just numbers. You know, it's 9 people off the coast of this and 12 people off the coast of that. And you don't really understand who these people are or why they're driven to leave a country they call home. And so we really wanted to just, you know, make this very tangible.
Malim says he wants his fashion pieces to tell the story about the journey of the refugee who wore it.
3 people have to go now. Mohammed and Fatima.
Kali Abdu for VOA News, Washington.
While they were holding hands, Samira was 6 months pregnant, but still required to meet those demands.
Outrage has erupted in South Africa over a video of the president's security officers stomping on a man on a freeway over the weekend. The clip shows a group of armed plainclothes officers assigned to protect Deputy President Paul Masatelli dragging the man out of a car and then stomping him on his head until he lies motionless. At least 3 of the 7 officers involved are also seen kicking another man who holds his hands over his head to protect himself. Masatali's office said in a statement that he abhors any unnecessary use of force, particularly against unarmed civilians. The Independence Police Investigation Directorate, which handles cases of misconduct by police, said it has opened an investigation into the alleged assault by police officers. The Police Protection Unit is known in South Africa as the Blue Light Brigade and has a reputation of using excessive force. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 9:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.